On June 22, 2012, a judge in Marion County, Indiana signed an order that changed a date on paper and, with it, the rules around a child's life. The paperwork said the girl was born in 1989. The change made her an adult in the eyes of the state. Services tied to childhood could end. Schooling could shift. Guardianship could look different. Police, doctors, and caseworkers would read the file and follow that age. The order joined a case that already had tensions. An adoption in 2010. A prior placement in 2008. A rare form of dwarfism that complicated age tests. Neighbors, teachers, and doctors had seen pieces of the story. The order asked them to see it in a new frame. If the law said adult, what duty did any family owe? If the law was wrong, what duty did the system owe the child behind it? Chapter 1, Paper Ages. The court order arrived with a stamp date and a single conclusion. The girl now had a birth year of 1989. The words were plain. The effect was not. Agencies that had served a child would now address an adult. A school record would need review. A care plan could be rewritten. A lease could be signed. A doctor might read consent forms in a new way. The order did not tell the whole story. It set the rules for how others would move. 2 years earlier, in the spring of 2010, the Barnetts had adopted the girl through the Indiana courts. Before that, in 2008, she had been placed with the Ciccone family. Each step left a trail. Intake forms. Clinic notes. Teacher observations. The documents did not match at every point. There were medical estimates that placed her as a child in 2010. There were other voices that said she seemed older. Her rare form of dwarfism made bone surveys and growth charts less clear. The record bent under the weight of uncertainty, then snapped to a legal age on one day in June. The new age turned private duties into public questions. If your child becomes an adult by court order, what happens to daily care? Who pays for therapy? Who sets the rules at home? If the child is an adult, a parent may shift to advisor. If the child is a child, a parent remains responsible. The order did not answer how to handle fear, conflict, and trust inside a home. It did not tell a school how to handle a desk that sat empty. It changed lanes, but left the traffic moving. At home, the talk turned to appointments and safety. The family had already seen stress grow. Doctors were involved. Teachers had opinions. Neighbors noticed strain. Allegations were made inside the house. Outside, professionals tried to sort signal from noise. Proven facts stayed narrow. The adoption was real. The disability was real. The new legal age was real. Many of the claims about behavior and intent stayed in dispute. The order did not decide them. It only marked the birth year. In Indiana, a legal age change reaches far. It can change special education eligibility. It can change access to pediatric specialists. It can shift which court hears a dispute. It can shape who speaks for the person at a clinic desk. The Barnetts now had a document that said adult. That affected how agencies viewed reports of risk. It touched landlord decisions. It touched how police would code a call. When an age shifts, the system often shifts with it. The girl still had daily needs. She needed food, housing, and follow-up care for a body that worked in a different way. She needed a plan for work or school. She needed transportation for appointments. If the law said she was 22, the state could treat her as independent. If she was closer to 9 or 10 in function, independence would be hard. The gap between paper and life grew wide. That gap would shape what came next. By the summer after the court order, lines were already moving. There were discussions about how to teach adult daily living skills. There were talks about where she would live. Independence became a word that carried risk. It also carried relief for a family under strain. If an adult could live alone, a parent could step back. If a child could not, a parent had to stay close. The move from one frame to the other is not simple. The order made it fast. Doctors did not agree on the age in those years. A skeletal survey had one estimate. Other specialists warned that such tests can mislead when bone growth does not follow standard curves. An endocrinology note in 2010 had a younger range. The court weighed a set of filings and settled the legal question in 2012. Later hearings would affirm that choice. Science kept offering ranges. The law held to a single number. The split would echo through wellness checks, welfare calls, and courtrooms ahead. The public record shows two lanes of language. One lane says proven. The adoption in 2010 is proven. The existence of a rare dwarfism is proven. The 2012 order is proven. The later neglect charges and their outcomes are proven by verdicts and dismissals. The other lane says alleged. Threats and plots inside the home are alleged. Medical facts beyond the charts and filings are alleged. Motive is alleged on all sides. This chapter holds to the first lane and marks the second as open questions. Educators who work with complex needs often warn about the weight of labels. Age is the heaviest label a system can place. It controls doors. It sets deadlines. It draws a line that others will not cross. In this case, the label did more than guide services. It defined the story for many readers. A neighbor would recall the number and form an opinion. A reporter would write the number and shape a headline. A juror, years later, would not hear that number in a trial because of rules of evidence. The number still sat in the file. The day the order was signed looked routine on paper. It was an entry in a docket. It was a direction to a state office to issue a new certificate. The language was formal and brief. The meaning reached into kitchens and waiting rooms. It made an apartment key feel like a test of adulthood. It made a school meeting feel out of place. It made a doctor pause before calling a parent into a room. The order set a tone that people would follow even when their eyes told them something else. Families who adopt across borders know that records can be thin. Names change. Translations vary. Early medical files can be missing. When a child has a rare condition, uncertainty grows. This case placed that uncertainty inside a courtroom. The judge had to decide with what was in front of the bench. Once the order was set, later courts had to work around it. Some tried to revisit. Others said the first decision controlled. The system prefers final answers. Life does not. By the end of 2012, the file said the girl was over 18. The family began to test what that meant. Adult skills. Adult housing. Adult rules. The stakes were high either way. If she was a child in truth, independence could harm her. If she was an adult in truth, delay could harm her in a different way. Services for youth would not fit. Services for adults might not exist or would be hard to reach. The gap stayed open. This chapter sits at that hinge. It holds the order up to the light. It states what the file said and what the file changed. It notes what was proven and what stayed in dispute. It leaves motives to later chapters. It marks the first stake that ran through every choice that followed. If the law calls you an adult, how do people treat you when you need more help than the word suggests? If the law is wrong, how do you prove it without the support the law removed? The next chapter steps inside the house. It shows daily care, early appointments, and the way stress built over 2 years. It keeps the same rules. Proven on one side, alleged on the other. It follows the people who tried to make sense of a number that did not match what they saw. Chapter 2, Inside the Barnett Home. The house in suburban Indiana held a new routine in the spring of 2010. A child arrived with a file from overseas and a diagnosis that explained small stature and joint pain. The days filled with appointments, forms, and school decisions. The family learned how to lift without hurting her hips. They learned the rhythm of clinics and waiting rooms. They learned how to translate medical advice into daily care. Proven facts set the frame for this period. The adoption took place in 2010 under Indiana law. The child had a form of dwarfism that affects bone growth and mobility. By early 2012, child services in a neighboring county opened an investigation that put the family under official review. Those events are in records that carry legal weight. What people felt in the kitchen and hallway never reached that level of proof. The first months turned on practical tasks. Finding a primary care doctor who understood rare bone disorders. Scheduling imaging that could be done without trauma. Tracking pain after a day at school. Making sure the bathroom could be used safely. The family asked how to fit a walker near the table. They asked whether braces would help. They asked what to expect as the child grew. Each answer was conditional, because growth did not follow the charts used for most children. School talks moved alongside the medical work. Staff asked about support in class and on the bus. They asked about bathroom access and lifting. They looked at age on paper, grade placement, and services. The age line already floated in early notes as a question that could not be settled by a glance. Growth patterns complicated bone age reads. Dental exams offered ranges. A single number kept slipping out of reach. Adults around the child kept working while the question sat there. stress grew in the home. That is a common truth in families who bring a child with complex needs into an already busy life. Long days at clinics, full nights of care, and the slow grind of paperwork wear people down. In this house, stress rose in public enough that an agency opened a file in March of 2012. That date matters. When a file opens, the language changes. Words like duty, safety plan, and placement enter the conversations. People speak into notes that others will read. Medical records in those years included age estimates, but they did not agree. A primary doctor and a social worker offered views that leaned older. Other medical voices pointed back to the limits of those tools for a person with bone growth that diverges from standard paths. The family heard both. The state heard both. The argument did not resolve in a clinic room. It traveled to a probate court where a judge would make it singular. The home life involved ordinary acts that grew heavy under scrutiny. Cooking meals that matched calorie needs for small bodies with high energy use. Reminding about hygiene and medication. Checking for pressure points on skin. Carrying groceries in one hand and a support device in the other. Every small decision can be second-guessed after the fact when a case becomes public. In the moment, most families make the next right choice they can see. Allegations surfaced from inside the home during this period. They involved threat, manipulation, and fear. They live in interviews, memoirs, and later shows. They did not reach the status of proven acts in a courtroom for these years. The record that matters for this chapter remains simple. An adoption. A diagnosis. An agency review by spring of 2012. A petition to change legal age in June of that year. Everything else sits in dispute. Caregiver stress has patterns professionals recognize. Sleep debt. Missed meals. Rising voice tones. Withdrawal from friends. Anger at small things. Families often hit those marks during the first 2 years after adoption when medical needs are high. It is reasonable to infer stress here based on the pace of care, the agency timeline, and later filings. It is not possible to assign motive or malice from that alone. The chapter holds that line. Neighbors remember fragments of any family in crisis. A call to police when a disagreement spills outdoors. A visit from an officer who leaves without charges. A wellness check at the request of a teacher or a social services worker. Those fragments rarely capture context. They capture sound, faces, and time of day. In this case, fragments would later become fuel for competing narratives. For this period, they remain context, not conclusion. A rare bone disorder like diastrophic dysplasia brings physical limits and pain spikes. It also brings stigma and misunderstanding in public spaces. The child needed help with steps and curbs. She needed careful seat choice on a bus. She needed longer time to move between rooms. Anyone who has lived that rhythm knows how it strains schedules and patience. The family had to blend logistics and love. People outside the home had to learn how to help without harm. The school team tried to match services to need. Eligibility depends on age and function. The age on file pointed one way. The lived picture sometimes pointed another. Teams can adapt when a child struggles with fine motor tasks or stamina. They cannot overwrite an official birth year on their own. When a legal change came in June of 2012, the team would have to adjust again. That is the structural reality in any district. The investigation in March of 2012 raised the stakes. When an agency opens a case, every decision echoes. A doctor's note about age now lands in a file that could trigger larger steps. A parent's report about behavior now has an audience with power to act. The family signaled they planned to seek a legal age change while the investigation was still open. That decision drew the medical debate into a legal forum where one number would be chosen. Why families seek an age change varies. Services are often tied to age bands. Legal rights for consent depend on age. A mismatch between paper and life can cause harm on either side. Remaining a child on paper can trap a person who needs adult tools to live well. Becoming an adult on paper can strip support from a person who still functions like a minor. In this case, the family argued for the latter path. The court granted it. The details of the filings remained sensitive. The impact on daily life was not. Inside the house, the order landed like a new rulebook. The language of care shifted. An adult can be left at home without supervision for hours. An adult can sign for medical procedures. An adult can be asked to make meals, clean, and manage medication. An adult can be trained for independent living. All of those steps may still be unwise for some adults. Legally, they become possible. The family began to plan toward independence with that new status in mind. Allegations from later interviews claim that threats happened in the home before the legal change. They describe acts that would alarm any parent. Those claims remain in the lane of allegation. They were not charged in this period. The agency review did not produce a criminal case at that time. The chapter cannot move them into the proven column. It notes them as part of the contested story that shaped public opinion years later. Healthcare visits in this period also carried tension around pain control and growth. Providers record weight, height, and developmental markers. For a person with a rare condition, those entries can look irregular. One visit shows progress. The next shows regression after an illness. Families ride that wave. Care plans change. Equipment needs shift. Strain rises with each change. None of that proves intent or harm. It proves difficulty. By mid-2012, everyone around the case had to navigate two tracks. The medical track still asked a range for biological age. The legal track now had a fixed number. Agencies may not like that split. They follow the court. When the number said adult, a child services file in one county closed for lack of jurisdiction. That is a direct effect of a legal age change. It does not speak to what the person can do alone on a given day. It speaks to which office can act. School decisions followed the same split. Services attached to childhood can end when a person becomes an adult on paper. Transition plans can replace individualized education plans. The shift is rarely smooth when function does not match the number. Families in that position often feel abandoned. Staff often feel bound. That friction plays out in meetings and emails that never make headlines. It shapes outcomes more than any later broadcast. Caregiver stress peaked as the changes stacked up. Training for cooking and cleaning. Training for bus routes. Training for clinic check-ins and pharmacy calls. Every step has a fail point. Miss one, and the person falls behind quickly. In the best cases, a team cushions those falls. In fragile cases, falls compound. The home in this story headed toward a test of independence that would play out the next year. This chapter ends at the threshold, proven for this period. The adoption in 2010, the diagnosis of a rare dwarfism, the agency investigation in March of 2012, and the legal age change granted in June of 2012. Disputed for this period, claims of calculated threats inside the home and precise biological age. Those claims continued to circulate in interviews and television much later. They did not convert into court-proven facts for these years. The human picture remains clear even when the facts are limited. A child with complex needs entered a home. Adults tried to manage care, school, and strain. Systems moved in ways that did not always fit the person in front of them. The choice to fix a single number by court order set the course for what came next. The next chapter will follow that course into an apartment and a test of independence that defined the public story. Chapter 3, The Lafayette Apartment. The legal age change in June 2012 put the system on one track and daily life on another. First came a trial run at independent living in Hamilton County. When that lease ended, the plan moved west. In July 2013, the family relocated her to an apartment in Tippecanoe County, on a city bus line and near services a new renter might need. The move fixed a new center of gravity for police, schools, and social workers who were about to enter the story. The record is clear on several points. The apartment was chosen with practical access in mind. The family paid the first year of rent, then provided no additional financial support. Around the same time, they left for Canada with their biological children. The file also notes a monthly federal disability benefit in the amount of $733 that helped cover basic costs. Those are facts from court filings, not memories. Contact thinned after the move. The girl did not see Christine again. She saw Michael only once, years later, at a court hearing. That distance would later become part of the legal theory in Tippecanoe County. For now, it was a social fact felt in a small apartment near a bus stop. Adult Protective Services opened a file within weeks. In August and September of 2013, investigators interviewed both sides and reviewed documents, including the 2012 order that said she was an adult. The APS case closed without further action. The closure did not settle the broader question. It signaled how strongly the 2012 order shaped what local agencies could or could not do. The next ripple came from an adult reading academy in September 2014. Staff questioned the age classification they had been told to use. The sheriff's office opened an investigation that carried into 2015. Detectives met with prosecutors. They tried to pull sealed records from the probate case. They learned the age change had been filed under an adoption case type, which made the file confidential. The detective later testified that the prosecutor's office wanted to stabilize her situation and even looked for pro bono help. Those meetings created a paper trail. Marion County Adult Protective Services appeared in the age change case in April 2015 as an interested person and asked for a guardian ad litem. The probate court denied the request. The entry matters because it shows the state trying to reopen the question through a civil doorway while criminal prosecutors watched the clock on potential charges. Day to day, the apartment meant ordinary adult tasks, but with a body that needed accommodations. The bus got her to stores and clinics. Federal disability payments set a predictable floor, though not a generous one. Neighbors and landlords saw only fragments. A package left at the wrong door. A welfare check after a missed call. The record does not turn those fragments into proof either way. It shows an apartment chosen for access, a rent paid up front, and a young tenant managing a loan with a limited income. The law kept circling back to the number on the birth certificate. Local officers and social workers asked what they could do if the file said adult. Teachers and program staff asked what they should do if the person in front of them struggled like a much younger student. The conflict did not live in one office. It lived between two systems that were not built to resolve a disagreement about age when disability distorts the usual medical cues. By 2016, a new family in Tippecanoe County, Antoine and Cynthia Manns, stepped into the picture. They had befriended her and then offered a home. When they later tried to get guardianship through the local circuit court, the judge told them to challenge the age order first. That guidance pushed the fight back to Marion County Probate, where a hearing took place on March 7, 2017. The court reaffirmed the 1989 birth year. The number held. The systems followed it. The apartment chapter sits at the core of how the case became a case. It is where independence became the test. It is where agency files multiplied. It is where prosecutors weighed whether a neglect charge could survive a courtroom that would not hear evidence that contradicted the 2012 order. The later opinion from the Court of Appeals lays this out in plain language. The age order had consequences across child welfare jurisdiction, evidence limits, and how long the state could wait before filing. Proven for this period, the July 2013 move to the Tippecanoe County apartment on a bus line, payment of the first year's rent, the family's move to Canada, the monthly federal disability benefit, the August-September 2013 Adult Protective Services investigation closing with no action, the September 2014 complaint from an adult reading academy, the 2015 to 2016 investigative and guardianship steps, and the March 2017 probate ruling that left the 1989 birth year in place. Disputed for this period, claims about behavior inside the apartment that go beyond the documents and sworn testimony. This chapter keeps those claims in the lane of allegation. Indiana courts. The question that survives the apartment is simple and hard. If the person in the file is an adult, what standard of support satisfies law and ethics when function lags behind that label? If the person is not an adult, what remedy exists when the label blocks the office's meant to help? The next chapter enters the courtroom, where those questions turned into charges, rulings, and a verdict that did not, and could not, settle the science of age. It only set the legal outcome for two defendants in one county at one moment in time. Chapter 4, Cases in Courts. On August 25, 2021, Indiana's Court of Appeals published an opinion that set the ground under every later headline. It recounted the adoption in 2010, the age change order on June 22, 2012, and a probate hearing on March 7, 2017 that reaffirmed the 1989 birth year. It explained why prosecutors could not tell a jury that her legal age was wrong. The ruling said the earlier probate orders had legal force. The state, through agencies that appeared in those probate filings, had its chance to contest them and did not prevail. The charges came first. In September 2019, Tippecanoe County filed 8 counts against both Christine and Michael. Neglect of a dependent. Variants that alleged injury. Conspiracy counts. The case focused on decisions in 2012 and 2013 when she lived alone in apartments and the family moved to Canada. The appellate opinion later summarized the charge list and the dates tied to each count. Pre-trial fights decided the shape of the trial. The defense moved to block any evidence that contradicted the probate court's 2012 and 2017 age rulings. The trial judge agreed. The Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. It held that the age orders were not void. It held that state actors tied to child and adult protective services had been involved, which bound the state to those outcomes. A jury would not hear evidence that sought to relitigate age. Another ruling trimmed the case. Several counts were dismissed under the statute of limitations. The appellate court affirmed those dismissals. The opinion walked through the 5-year limit that applied to older offense levels and why concealment tolling did not fit the facts here. What remained for any jury had to fit inside the allowed time window and the probate age rulings. With the guardrails set, Michael went to trial in Tippecanoe County in October 2022. On October 27, 2022, a jury found him not guilty on all charges. Reporters noted the acquittal as the end of a 3-year local case against him. The verdict did not answer the age question. It answered only the charges as the court allowed them to be presented. Christine did not go to trial. On March 24, 2023, the prosecutor moved to dismiss her case, stating there was insufficient evidence to prove the charges beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge signed the order that day. Local outlets and the defense team confirmed the result. Like Michael's verdict, the dismissal did not settle the larger public debate. It closed one criminal file. Proven in this chapter are the filings and outcomes. The 2012 age change order and the 2017 reaffirmation. The August 25, 2021 appellate opinion that upheld key pretrial rulings and dismissals. The October 27, 2022 acquittal of Michael. The March 24, 2023 dismissal for Christine. Also proven are the limits those rulings placed on what a jury could hear. Disputed are motives, private statements, and any medical claims about biological age that never entered evidence in this courtroom. The legal takeaway is narrow and important. Courts decide what evidence jurors may consider. Here, probate rulings set the legal age for this criminal case. Appellate law bound the trial to that record. The state could not ask a jury to treat her as a minor when the probate file said adult. Once those walls were up, the neglect theory had to focus on disability and support, not on disputed birth data. That is how a timeline turned into a verdict and a dismissal, without answering the human question that still shadows this story. Chapter 5, A New Home, New Fractures. The apartment years ended with a door opened by a new family. They met her through church circles and local programs. They saw the limits of bus rides and short checks. They invited her into their home. Meals at a table replaced microwave dinners in a small kitchen. Rides to clinics replaced long waits on a curb. For a time, the house felt steady. They began the formal path to make care permanent. In early filings, they described a young person who needed help with daily living. They asked a court for guardianship. The judge told them to address the old age order first. That step pushed them into a courthouse miles away from the house where they were serving meals and teaching routines. A hearing came in March of 2017. The court reviewed earlier decisions and testimony. The prior order stood. The legal birth year stayed in the late 1980s. That result shaped everything that followed. The people in the house kept doing the work of care. The paper in the file kept calling that work support for an adult. Life in the new home settled into cycles. Morning medication checks. School or tutoring. Appointments for joints that hurt after short walks. Lists on a fridge. A weekly plan with bus routes and contact names. Small successes built trust. A misstep caused long drops. The household learned the cost of pace. Go too fast, and she stumbled. Go too slow, and she stalled. Trust cut both ways. She had moved through homes and offices since she arrived in the country. She watched faces change when forms appeared. She watched rules change when one number on a line changed. In the new home, she wanted a say. She wanted a phone. She wanted friends. The house had rules she did not like. Friction showed up in curfews, passwords, and chores. The family pushed to make the placement secure. Paperwork moved through the local system. It took time. It took hearings. It took letters from doctors and teachers. In the end, the bond became formal. After years of living together, they reached the point where the state recognized what the house had already practiced. The file caught up with the kitchen table. Legal permanence did not end strain. The same tight budget followed the new name. The same medical needs demanded time and transport. A growing young woman wanted choices that did not match the rules in the house. Arguments rose over internet use, friends, and private messages. The family said the rules protected her. She said the rules controlled her. Both sides felt unheard. Allegations formed around that strain. Some claimed the rules crossed lines. Others claimed the rules were the only way to keep order. Those claims appear in interviews and filings that came later. They remain in dispute. What stands as fact is simpler. A home was offered. A legal bond was formed. The relationship changed over the next year as trust broke down. By the end of that year, the house that once felt steady felt like another stop. She reached out to other adults who had stayed in touch. She looked for a place with fewer rules and more say. The move out of the house did not erase the legal bond. It changed the day-to-day. It moved the center of gravity to a new address and a new set of tasks. The break left questions with no clean answers. How strict should a house be when safety and freedom both matter? How much privacy does a young adult get when past harm is a risk? How much structure helps, and when does structure become control? The file rarely answers those questions. Homes answer them one evening at a time. Proven in this period are the steps that show intent to care and intent to formalize that care. A petition for guardianship. A court hearing that kept the old age order in place. A later legal bond that turned a placement into family. Disputed are the private acts that people describe years later in strong words. Those belong to the chapter of allegation, not the chapter of proof. The system again showed its split. One track recorded a birth year from an old ruling. Another track watched a young person move through the world with limits that did not match that number. Families who take that on often succeed with patience and support from outside. They stumble when isolation and stress grow. This house saw both forces at work. This chapter closes with a hinge, like the one that ended the apartment years. A new placement took form. It then fractured. The next chapter returns to the wider lens. Cameras, lab tests, and court records moved the story from private rooms back into public view. The facts remained the same size on paper. The audience grew. Chapter 6, TV, tests, and records. The story moved from filings to screens. A multi-night series aired first, centering the early years and the 2012 order. A follow-up put her voice front and center and promised answers about age. Viewers met a family, a court file, and a question the trial could not solve. During filming in August 2023, a private lab drew blood to estimate biological age. The method read chemical patterns on DNA that change over time. The estimate put her near 22 at that moment, close to what she believed and far from the number in the 2012 order. The result was presented on camera as a turning point, yet it remained an estimate, not a court ruling. Coverage after the broadcast repeated the headline number. Some stories treated it as strong support for the original 2003 birth year. Others reminded readers that epigenetic clocks have ranges and are not a substitute for legal records. The public took sides along that line. Court rules still mattered. Years earlier, an appellate opinion had explained why a jury could not hear evidence that contradicted the probate orders. That meant the trial measured care and safety under the age set by law, not under a disputed birth date. The opinion also walked through time limit dismissals that trimmed the case before any juror was seated. Local officials later released exhibits they could not use in court. Those materials included records from abroad that supported the younger birth year, and notes about how the case moved through agencies. They fueled debate, but did not reopen the verdict or the dismissal. The legal outcomes stood where the rulings left them. By 2025, a scripted series drew from the same record and from interviews the public already knew. It followed the adoption, the order, the charges, and the split between science, media, and the file. The show kept the case in view while her day-to-day life changed again. What is proven in this chapter is narrow. A televised age estimate placed her early 20s in 2023. An appellate opinion barred relitigation of age at trial and affirmed key dismissals. Local prosecutors shared exhibits outside the courtroom after the shows began. What stays disputed is broader. Motive inside each home. Meanings drawn from edited scenes. How much weight to give a lab estimate against prior court orders. Chapter 7. What's Proven, What's Disputed. This case ends with two short lists and one long lesson. What's proven? The adoption occurred in 2010. A court changed her birth year to 1989 on June 22, 2012. That order was reaffirmed on March 7, 2017. An appeals court on August 25, 2021 said those probate rulings controlled what later jurors could hear. Michael went to trial in October 2022 and was acquitted on October 27, 2022. Charges against Christine were dismissed on March 24, 2023. A televised lab estimate in August 2023 placed her biological age near 22 at that time. Later reporting shows formal placement with a new family in 2023 and ongoing public interest through 2025. These points sit in records with dates and captions. They are not opinion. What's disputed? Motive inside the homes is disputed. Exact biological age at earlier points is disputed. Private threats and the meaning of daily scenes are disputed. Edits in shows and interviews do not settle those questions. None of that reached a final judgment in a courtroom that heard evidence within the rules set by the appeals decision. What the system teaches. Age on paper controls doors. It decides which office acts. It decides what a jury may hear. When disability complicates testing, a single number may not match function. That split can harm either way. Call someone a child, and you may deny adult tools they need. Call someone an adult, and you may strip help they still require. Agencies need a route to review age when science changes, without tearing up settled cases at random. Courts need clearer rules on how prior orders limit later trials in neglect cases tied to disability. Families need steady support when stress rises and facts stay blurry. Duty of care, regardless of the number. Document risks early. Build an independent living plan with safeguards when function lags. Tie housing and transport to real access, not the closest line on a map. Use neutral case notes that mark proven on one side and alleged on the other. Train schools and clinics to serve a person whose file and function do not match. Set a review clock so teams revisit the plan when new tests arrive. The open question: what protection would have prevented harm here, no matter who was right about age? The answer is simple in shape and hard in practice. A plan that follows the person, not the label. A review that follows the evidence, not the noise. A court record that can adapt without breaking trust. That is the work left for the next case that looks almost like this one.